Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to this month's episode of Critical Decisions in Emergency Medicine podcast. With you is Dr. Danya Koja. I'm an emergency physician who practices in Florida.
That's right. And this is Dr. Wendy Chang. I'm an emergency physician and neurointensivist in the Baltimore, Washington area.
And today we're going to be talking about the Critical Decisions in Emergency Medicine publication, the September 2022 issue. And if you don't know what Critical Decisions is, what are you waiting for? Critical Decisions is ASAP's official CME publication. Each month, we talk about two lessons that are bread and butter emergency medicine or things that are cutting edge.
There are also a lot of other features, such as the critical procedure, the tox box, the drug box, and as our listeners know, my favorite, the LLSA review.
And for our first lesson of the day, we have Off the Hook, Management of Opioid Use Disorder. Thank you to Drs. Sharon Long, Mitchell Katona, Jason Kolb, and Amanda Dos Santos for writing this article. We are all familiar with the statistics on opioid-related deaths in the U.S. Why do we need to worry about the non-fatal opioid overdoses and opioid use disorder in the ED, though? Like, people are not dead.
That's true. Obviously, we know how to treat, you know, opioid overdoses as well as, you know, death and near-death experiences. But I think the important thing to know is our job definitely doesn't end after treating that overdose event because there's a high risk of death and complications following such an event. The ED, of course, serves as an entry point for many of these patients to the healthcare system. And we actually do have a role in potentially initiating medications for management of opioid use disorders. And it's quite simple. It helps control the patient's withdrawal symptoms, lowers the rate of overdoses in the future, and as well as mortality.
Great points. So how do we identify patients with opioid use disorder?
Well, there are a lot of screening tools, and certainly if you have additional assistance from social workers or substance use navigators, that's super helpful. But authors actually share that they have a single question they use in their ED, and it's simply asking, in the last week, have you struggled with painkillers or used heroin or fentanyl? And this simple question is actually quite sensitive in identifying these patients. I do think that it's important to also remember to screen, especially in pregnant women, patients presenting with psychiatric complaints, skin and soft tissue infections. And don't forget about even the patients who are asking or wanting to leave AMA. As we all know, a lot of times maybe that's driven by other factors, such as maybe they're experiencing withdrawal.
That's a great point. So let's talk about patients who may benefit from buprenorphine. Who are they and how can we make it happen?
Yeah, we're all familiar with opioid withdrawal symptoms, you know, whether it's anxiety, irritability, GI distress, diaphoresis, or mydriasis. And so I think also we are familiar with the clinical opioid withdrawal scale, which is, you know, scores on 0 to 36 points to quantify these withdrawal symptoms. Essentially, we're trying to identify patients who have moderate to severe withdrawal who would be good candidates for buprenorphine. And so that's really defined by a CALS greater than or equal to 8 points. And these are patients obviously having severe enough symptoms that could use this medication to treat the withdrawal symptoms, but also severe enough so that you're not precipitating a withdrawal in those who, you know, have no or mild symptoms. The article points out an interesting note, which is that clinical presentation of these symptoms are much more reliable than using, let's say, when the patient last used an opioid.
Those are great points. We definitely should try to find that Goldilocks happy sweet spot where patients are withdrawing, but not so much, so that we can actually try to give them buprenorphine. And definitely symptoms guide us way more than timing or dosage or anything like that. So let's say we identified that correct patient. What are we supposed to do after that? What's our next step?
So the nitty-gritty is that you would administer buprenorphine, the sublingual films, and you would start with 8 milligrams. You want the patient to take nothing else by mouth for 15 minutes so that sublingual film can completely dissolve. And then you're going to monitor for 30 to 60 minutes to see if they're responding appropriately for control of their withdrawal symptoms. If their symptoms improve, then you want to give a second dose of 8 milligrams to complete the loading dose. You can give, of course, more for more severe symptoms, but it what you want to avoid is giving lower than these suggested doses, because that can actually paradoxically precipitate withdrawal. If the patient is presenting because they're unfortunately experiencing withdrawal after they've received buprenorphine or naloxone, and then these patients are going to need much higher doses. So these patients may need 8 to 16 milligrams every 1 to 2 hours, up to a max of 32 milligrams.
Got it. So how about the patient that comes in with opioid use disorder and they don't have any withdrawal symptoms, or their symptoms of withdrawal are really mild? From what you just said, they're not good candidates for giving them buprenorphine in the emergency department, because then we're going to be precipitating withdrawal. So what are we supposed to do?
That's right. We can, though, still offer them buprenorphine as a prescription to initiate it at home. The key, of course, is for these patients to wait until their symptoms are moderate, to severe before starting their dose. And so the instructions you want to give them is that they can take 4 milligrams sublingually every 2 hours, up to 24 milligrams on their first day. And then they're going to continue 8 milligrams BID until they're able to see an outpatient appointment to continue this. We want to do this for patients who have no or mild withdrawal symptoms, because we know that patients who are started on medications for their opioid use disorder are more likely to remain in treatment, less likely to require hospitalizations or ED visits, or even engage in criminal activities. And that this is actually safe also in pregnant and breastfeeding patients.
Definitely great reminders to allow us to expand this care to as many patients as possible. So let's bring this back to reality, okay? We talked about how we're supposed to do it, but how do we actually do it? Can we just all prescribe buprenorphine? Is that even allowed?
Yeah, I think this is the confusing part, even for me, until I read through this article and learned more about it through some of the resources the authors provided. So I think a lot of us have heard about an X waiver and how that applies in the prescription of buprenorphine. But actually, just simply to treat patients in the emergency department or the inpatient hospital setting for opioid use disorder and opioid withdrawal, you don't need an X waiver to treat these patients up to 72 hours. So logistically, maybe it's somebody that you want to start them on this. They could either return to the ED and get their dose in consecutive days, or be dispensed a 3-day supply. To prescribe buprenorphine, of course, then you do need this X waiver. And this can be done by any clinician with a valid medical license and a DEA. And you can apply for this X waiver in just 5 minutes. It's free application, and it's about a 45-day turnaround. Once you get an X waiver, then you can prescribe buprenorphine to up to 30 patients. If your clinical practice, needs you to prescribe this to more than 30 patients, then you need to actually attend special training. So physicians then need 8 hours of training to be able to get additional exemption to treat more patients.
Definitely great reminder that the X waiver is really easy to apply for. I actually applied for it for the, 30 patients or less thing, and I got my response in less than a week. So it is way simpler than you think it is. You just go online, you apply for it, and it takes less than ordering something from Amazon. So great. So what else can we do for these patients in our emergency department other than screen for them and try to initiate buprenorphine if they are the correct patient candidates for that?
Well, we can also try and reduce the harm that these patients experience through other ways, such as, advising them, educating them on safe injection practices, whether it is not using drugs alone, making sure they have naloxone, right? Using drug testing strips to make sure they know what they're using is what they think they're using, clean needles, etc. Don't forget HIV and Hep C screening. And then a lot of also other non-maybe medical things that we think about, like reducing stigma. And then if they are presenting for medical issues other than their opioid use disorder, such as acute injuries and pain, don't forget to treat their pain adequately too.
Such great reminders. Thank you, Wendy, for going through this article. And thank you again to the authors for writing about this very important topic. We are the people who see patients with opioid use disorder as day in and day out. We need to screen for them. One question is enough. In the last week, have you struggled with painkillers or used heroin or fentanyl? Especially in pregnant people, people with psychiatric complaints, and people with skin and soft tissue infections, and people who are trying to leave AMA. If a patient is interested, they may be good candidates for buprenorphine if they are in withdrawal, if their CAL scale is equal to or more than 8. If not, then we may consider home treatment for them. We would basically give them the sublingual buprenorphine, watch them for 15 minutes, consider redosing, and do that up to a max of 32 milligrams. It's super important to make sure that patients have follow-up and have somebody consistent to prescribe that buprenorphine for them. What we can do is that for us, we can apply for the X waiver, which basically means that we can actually prescribe patients up to 3 days of their buprenorphine supply to a maximum of 30 patients, which should be more than enough for us in the emergency department. And last but not least, we are there for our patients. There's a lot of things that we can do outside of just offering them buprenorphine. There's a lot of harm reduction strategies that we may be able to discuss with them and help reduce the harm for our patients.
That was a great summary. Thank you, Danya.
So moving on to a different topic, our clinical pediatrics this month is about ectopic pregnancy. So for some reason, I don't think of ectopic and pediatric in the same sentence, but we should.
Absolutely. This is a case of an ectopic pregnancy in a 16-year-old who knew she was pregnant. Her presentation was syncope, abdominal pain, and vaginal bleeding, which, you know, often alerts us for a possible ectopic pregnancy. We need to be vigilant for these patients, even if the patient says that it is impossible for them to be pregnant.
Remember that in half of the patients who present with an ectopic pregnancy, the pregnancy is not identified on the ultrasound. You're not going to actually see that ectopic pregnancy. You're just going to have to guess that that's the problem. There's patients who have risk factors such as prior tubal surgery, prior ectopic pregnancy, PID, and getting pregnant with an IUD in place. Like 50% of those pregnancies are ectopic. However, half of the people who are going to come in with an ectopic pregnancy have zero risk factors. So if you only think of ectopic in people with risk factors, you're missing half of the ones that are out there.
Ooh, that's scary. Oftentimes, we obviously use ultrasound and you're looking for a gestational sac and a yolk sac via the transabdominal approach when your HCG is greater than 6,500 IU per liter, or via the transvaginal approach at 1 to 2,000, the discriminatory threshold. Obviously, if you can't identify an IUP with these particular thresholds, then the risk of ectopic is about 36%. It's important to know that there's no single measurable quantitative HCG level that can rule out an ectopic pregnancy or predict a benign clinical course. And an ectopic pregnancy can actually be present even with rising, stable, or falling HCG levels. So any of those.
Finally, if you identify an intrauterine pregnancy or an IUP, that's almost enough to rule out an ectopic, except in patients with ovulation induction or assisted conception, as the risk of heterotopic pregnancy, which is having both an IUP and an ectopic at the same time, is 1 in 100. So that's a lot.
Yes, agreed. If you do identify an ectopic pregnancy, you know, 20 to 35% of these are treated non-surgically, usually with methotrexate, and these are usually in patients who are asymptomatic and have good follow-up. But 15% of these patients will still require some sort of surgery.
A quick review of an important topic in both peds and adults. And moving on to something completely different, again, our critical ECG this month is accelerated junctional tachycardia. And this EKG's goal in life is to remind us that just because there's a P wave, that does not mean that the patient is in sinus rhythm. In this particular case, the PR is way too short for it to be normal sinus rhythm. It like makes no sense that electricity went from the atria to the ventricle. So it must be either a junctional rhythm or an accessory pathway. And there's nothing else on the EKG that, you know, hints toward an accessory pathway. Now, usually junctional rhythms are like 40 to 60. So in this case, since it's like 115, it's called an accelerated junctional rhythm. The reason this is important And the reason this case is actually quite interesting is that the patient came in, they were tachycardic. Everybody assumed that it's sinus tachycardia, and they kept trying to volume resuscitate this person, but like they didn't need resuscitation because they were not tachycardic because they're, you know, volume down. It's because they're not in sinus tachycardia. And eventually, a few hours later, when the people taking care of this patient realized that it's not sinus tachycardia, they just gave him a little bit of beta blocker and he converted to a sinus rhythm with a heart rate of 75. Ta-da!
Woo! And the patient became volume overloaded. Not
kidding. Okay, but this is going to be a happy story, Wendy, okay?
Yes, no. A good reminder that we should get EKGs on our tachycardic patients to investigate more on the etiology of the tachycardia.
Exactly. Not all tachycardia is gift of fluids. So moving on to our LLSA review, community-acquired pneumonia. We're going to be talking about the article by Metley et al. That was published in 2019, American Journal of Respiratory Critical Care Medicine, that's entitled Diagnosis and Treatment of Adults with Community-Acquired Pneumonia, an official clinical practice guideline of the American Thoracic Society and Infectious Diseases Society of America.
That's right. This was a very useful article, guideline, as well as LLSA review. And I think all of our listeners should definitely take a look because it's also laid out very nicely based on a question and answer format. So let's start off with some common questions. Should we get sputum cultures in patients presenting with pneumonia? So these guidelines suggest that we should only obtain sputum gram stain culture in patients in the inpatient setting. And if those are presenting with severe community-acquired pneumonia or high risk for MRSA or Pseudomonas, then you can consider, you know, blood cultures or specific testing for Legionella, pneumococcal urinary antigen based on, again, risk factors. If influenza is present in the community at the time that you're taking care of the patient, then influenza testing should also be performed, preferably with nucleic acid testing. I think a lot of sites are now using procalcitonin as an adjunct to infectious evaluations, but it's important to remember that procalcitonin should not be used to withhold the initiation of empiric antibiotics, and rather you should still use validated tools such as the pneumonia severity index, the PSI, plus clinical judgment to determine the need for hospitalization, as well as those who need ICU care. There's a great table in this article that outlines the IDSA and ATS criteria.
Such great pearls. So let's talk about even simpler things, not like cultures and fancy things. What antibiotics should we give these people?
We all know this. If you're dealing with outpatient community-acquired pneumonia in a healthy patient, then you can use amoxicillin, doxycycline, or a macrolide. In patients with comorbidities, you want to add clavulanate to the amoxicillin or use cephalosporin in addition to the macrolide. You can also just use a respiratory fluoroquinolone. If you're dealing with patients who need to be admitted, you know, these patients, you want to utilize the beta-lactams plus a macrolide or doxycycline, or once again, just a respiratory fluoroquinolone. But doxycycline itself, though, is not a good option for severe community-acquired pneumonia. Now, if you're dealing with aspiration pneumonia, we don't actually need to add any additional coverage. This is often done, unfortunately, unless, you know, there's a particular concern about abscess or empyema. And then in terms of healthcare-associated pneumonia, which is no longer an actual category, if the patient has risk factors for MRSA or Pseudomonas specifically, then you should make sure that they have appropriate coverage for those. If the patient requires treatment for community-acquired pneumonia and tests positive for influenza, then you should also consider antiviral therapy in addition to the antibacterials. And finally, if patients are responding to your treatment, then just 5 days of antimicrobial course would be sufficient, or until, of course, you know, their clinical condition improves. Repeat imaging, though, is not necessary.
Great pearls to take care of a common presentation that we see in our emergency departments or even urgent cares. So great for us to review the guidelines themselves. Now, moving on to the critical image, entitled Importance of Incidental Findings. Ta-ta-da! This is a case of a 50-year-old intoxicated male who presents with a fall, who of course gets a head and C-spine CT, and guess what the next CT shows?
Well, I'm guessing by that lead-in, not a fracture, and I'm guessing by the fact that it's the next CT, maybe a thyroid mass?
Nope. It's tuberculosis.
Whoa.
So, I know. So as a quick refresher, tuberculosis may be latent or active, and if a patient has active TB, they need respiratory isolation and they need sputum testing for acid-fast bacilli before they can, you know, go back to joining the world. And high-risk features that should raise our concerns regarding active TB are apical cavitary disease, which this patient had, and that's why, you know, they could see it on the next CT. Patients can also have superior lobe consolidation, clustered tree and bud or miliary nodules, lymphadenopathy, and pleural effusion. And keep in mind that other than, you know, making sure that we take care of our patients, the CDC recommends that all suspected or confirmed cases of TB be reported within 24 hours. And penalties may apply for failure to report. Even latent TB must be reported in some jurisdictions. So it's not just the patient we need to tell that they have the TB. It's also the CDC.
I see. Now, when it comes to incidental findings, unfortunately, we don't do as good of a job as we could. There was a study on trauma patients, and 1/3 of the CTs had documented incidental findings. Unfortunately, less than 10% were reported to patients in written discharge material, which is concerning because clinicians can be held accountable for this.
The critical image article is a great eye-opener as always. So take a moment, take a look at the images, and remember, if it's TB or any incidental finding, please tell the people. So moving on to other things that have to do with radiology, critical cases in orthopedics and trauma, occult talus fracture.
Well, this was a case of a 44-year-old female who had MBC and presenting with ankle pain and swelling. Her x-rays actually were negative, but due to the high index of suspicion, a CT was obtained and she was found to have a talus fracture, which actually extends into the joint space.
As a reminder, x-rays are only 74% sensitive for this diagnosis. We can do the canal view, which basically the foot would be in like maximal equinus and at 15 degrees pronation, and the x-ray beam hits it as a 75 degree angle cranial from the horizontal. So just basically super weird angle. And that may improve the detection because it's looking directly at the talus itself. However, you may still not be able to see it and you'd need to get that CT.
Now, once you find these fractures, you have to remember that they are at high risk for avascular necrosis, which is increased in the setting of a tibiotalar or a subtalar dislocation. Some of these can be managed non-op, but given this high risk of complications, all patients should be referred to orthopedics or podiatry. In the ED, we want to place them in a short leg splint, and you can also consider adding a stirrup splint and have them follow up. Emergency consultation, though, is necessary if you cannot, you know, reduce the dislocation.
Great reminders for a not-so-common fracture that can have such terrible consequences. And now shifting gears all the way up to the eyes, our critical procedure this month is irrigation of the eyes. And I actually think it's more of a hack than like a full-on procedure. Quite simply, if a patient needs ocular decontamination, just use a nasal cannula to irrigate both eyes at the same time. And if this sounds weird, well, I mean, it sounds weird. It's a nasal cannula in somebody's eye. Just take a look at the image in the article and it will make so much sense. Consider using tetracaine to help with numbing the eyes. And you can also add like 10 ml of the 1% lidocaine to 1 liter of warm normal saline so that when you're irrigating the eye, it's not as annoying.
That's a great trick.
Or as the kids these days call it, hack.
Kids know what hacks are?
Yes, not the hacks like the car hacks. Like a life hack.
I see. Okay.
And for our second lesson of this issue, we have old school, new approaches to geriatric care. Thank you to Drs. Nicole Simino-Fialis and me. Wait, Wendy, maybe you should be introducing this article.
That's right. We're so lucky to have both authors with us on this podcast today.
Well, Wendy, you're kind of stuck with me, so I'm not really sure that you're that happy to have me around. But Nicole is here, so welcome, Dr. Fialos.
Thank you so much for having me.
So why did you two write this article?
So I have quite the soft spot for older adults, especially in the emergency department, which is where I practice. And Dr. Kuja and I recognize that there are a lot of older adults in the emergency department and also in the hospital and the ICU that would benefit from some extra accommodations. And we saw during COVID, especially, that these older adults have unique needs, and there are things we can do to help make them more comfortable and help them have better outcomes from the emergency department and ultimately hospitalizations.
Quite well said, Nicole. And the cases in the beginning of the lesson really highlight some common scenarios that every single one of us deals with on a regular basis. Your chest pain in an older adult with multiple risk factors with a meh EKG. A fall in a 75-year-old who's, oh, they're fine, right? And of course, COVID.
All right, then let's start with COVID. So the article says the global COVID-19 pandemic assaulted the world but ravaged the geriatric population. That's quite impactful. Let's tell us a little bit more.
So we all saw this with our own eyes when these older adults came into the emergency department at the beginning of COVID. And even now, I've still seen some pretty sick older adults with COVID-19. These patients are unfortunately much more likely to die, many times more likely to die from COVID, especially unvaccinated. I work in a population that we are still seeing some older adults that are unvaccinated. I think nationally, greater than 90% of older adults have been vaccinated against COVID, and that does improve their outcomes. We also have medications now to help take care of these patients and hopefully produce better outcomes that we didn't have in the beginning. But we still do see unvaccinated patients in my area. Patients that are vaccinated, they have a lot of comorbidities, and so they still get really sick. And so this can be a very serious condition for them. These patients also don't present typically, whereas a younger adult might present with cough, cold, runny nose, I don't feel good, I feel like I got hit by a truck. Older adults come in. I had a patient test positive just yesterday on my shift for COVID, and her complaint was altered mental status, and she was just having an experience of agitated delirium. So we really had to pay attention to all sorts of symptoms in these older adults when they came in with COVID, and we're still learning more about it.
And of course, we can't ignore the fact that there's still a lot of people avoiding the emergency department for fear of exposure, especially our older adults. And that has a lot of negative effects on how quickly we diagnose them and how quickly we can take care of them, as well as, of course, the physical and mental effects of the isolation itself.
That makes sense. But outside of COVID, what makes older adults so unique that they need a separate emergency department?
So I think saying that we need a separate emergency department for these patients might be a little bit strong, but to say that these older adults need accommodations in our emergency department because they are a unique population, and we should try to make accommodations as best we can to optimize their emergency department stay. We know that patients over the age of 75, most of them have some functional problems, a geriatric syndrome like frailty or cognitive deficits. Approximately half of patients over this age require some assistance with their activities of daily living. Up to 2/3 of the patients that come into the emergency department are going to need help toileting, dressing themselves, getting cleaned up, those types of things. Patients that come into the emergency department, a lot of them have cognitive impairment. They need assistance with ambulation. They're high risk for falls. And the emergency department is just a high risk experience for them because they're in a new place where they're not comfortable. They don't know exactly what's going on. They may get disoriented, and they're experiencing some acute exacerbation of a medical problem. And if we're going to be sending these patients home, we have to ensure that we make it as safe as possible. And then if the patient has to be admitted, we need to work on avoiding iatrogenic complications. We don't want to make these patients worse. We don't want them to fall while they're in the hospital. Don't want them to become delirious while they're in the hospital. We don't want them to get deconditioned. And these are all things that they're at risk for and need to be considered when weighing the benefits of discharge versus admission. And we want to be cognizant of whichever disposition we're headed for, that we're optimizing it to the best of the patient's needs.
All of these things do help us with geriatric-focused emergency departments with decreasing the rate of admissions and decreasing the costs because we can give people that care that they need.
Got it. So I guess let's start with, you know, the first part of their ED visit. Is there any difference in triaging these older adults?
So we always tell our patients that the emergency department is not like a restaurant. It's not first come, first serve. It's sicker patients get seen first. And we use the emergency severity index to decide who is sickest. And this is heavily based on vital signs, which unfortunately is biased against older adults. A lot of older adults will not mount a tachycardia when they're sick, or they're on beta blockers that prevent a tachycardia. Many older adults can't mount a fever when they're sick because that fever response is blunted in older populations. And these patients will often get under triaged, which delays their care. They're not seen as urgently as might be warranted. Some proposals have come out to change the thresholds of triage for older adults. These haven't been fully validated yet, but the point is that triage may not be capturing how sick an older adult is. For example, this has been studied in trauma. Older adults, even just a ground level fall, can be severely injured, and this can be missed because the triage protocols are not as good at detecting severity of injury. And this can lead to increased mortality. It decides where patients are transferred sometimes. And so we just have to be cognizant that our triage system may not be as effective in older adults as we would like it to be.
Another thing to consider in the triage of older adults is that we need to screen them for geriatric syndromes and identify those patients who are at risk for poor outcomes, things like readmission, functional decline, or death. There are lots of tools that we can use, like the ISAR, the TRST, Silver Code, etc. But the evidence is unclear on which is the best tool to use, but it's something to think about and consider in your ED.
Other than triage, though, what is different in maybe the setup of these EDs?
Well, the hospital loves to take pictures of these EDs when they build them because they're definitely prettier with nicer colors and soft lighting and better flooring. But that's really not what we're focusing on when we're talking about making a geriatric emergency department. So yes, it's nice to have pretty colors on the walls and, you know, maybe you play some soft white noise or something to drown out ambient noise. But really the things that matter in changing an emergency department to benefit older adults would be adequate lighting. Older adults need better lighting to see than younger adults. Having signage with large font, easy to read graphics, having a large font clock, orientation aids in the room. Patients are very easily disoriented. I always call the emergency department a really bad casino. There's no windows. There's no clues as to what time it is. It's kind of chaotic, and that can be really disorienting for older adults. So having...
And you never win at this casino.
Nobody's winning. Everyone's having a really bad night in this casino. So, but the point being that you want to give patients the best tools you can to keep them oriented, to prevent delirium and to prevent falls, because they are going to be trying to get to the bathroom with, you know, different ambulatory aids than they're used to. They don't know exactly where they're going. They are attached to different monitors. So anything you can do to keep them oriented, make sure they have access to help if they need it, know where they're going if they're trying to get to the bathroom or to get something to drink or what have you. These are really simple things as opposed to remodeling and building, you know, a new area. You can augment your ED to be more geriatric friendly.
There are also many things that we do that are actually useless or even counterproductive, like these fall bracelets. I don't understand why we put them on patients. Like, okay, they don't work. People still fall. Or this obsession that we have with bed rails, pulling up the bed rails on everybody. They make people feel like they're caged. They don't decrease the risk of fall. And actually, when people do fall, they increase the risk of injury because now you have this extra thing that you can injure yourself on.
Very good points. Are there any physical changes that we can implement?
So anything we can do to reduce the risk of delirium or agitation in the emergency department is a win for our older adult patients. I am known kind of as the geriatric guru in my ED. This is what I love to talk about. It's what I'm interested in. And what I often get is I'll have a co-physician come to me and they're like, I need to sedate this lady in bed 9 and I don't know which medication to use. Can you help me? And I'll say, sure, let's go see this lady in bed 9. Meanwhile, she's all alone in a dark room. She's tied to the monitor. There's been a Foley catheter placed for reasons that are unclear. The lights are off. She doesn't have her glasses. She can't hear. Like, of course she's agitated. So doing anything you can, maybe offering a sitter, giving her some orientation clues, limiting, tying the patient to the bed with different leads and monitors if you don't need them, trying to have the lights on during the day, off at night, making sure patients have their glasses so they can see and know where they are, making sure they have hearing aids if they're available, if they brought them with them. And if family is available to come and be with the patient, that's also helpful to keep them oriented. And so by doing those things up front, you can hopefully avoid this very, what should be last resort, sedation, restraints, those types of things. And so that's what I share with my providers, and that's what I try to encourage other emergency departments that maybe can't do these big physical modifications. Are there smaller things we can do to make patients more comfortable and prevent this delirium while they're in the ED?
That makes sense. A lot of the same, definitely, techniques we do for our neurologically injured patients. So what about staffing, though? Do we have to think about different types of staffing models in geriatric EDs?
Having additional staffing is definitely helpful. For example, having pharmacists can help review patients' medications, especially given that polypharmacy is quite prevalent in older adults. And medication-related problems are actually quite common. There was a study that's mentioned in the article where the pharmacist or the clinical pharmacy specialist identified at least one medication problem in almost half of the older adults. That's a lot. There are other people that can help in a geriatric emergency department, such as volunteers, easier access to physical therapists, and so on.
Got it. Are there any other things we can do better for our older adult patients?
There are so many things that we can do better for older adult patients. People ask me why I care about geriatric emergency medicine or why I chose this as something to focus on. And I like to say it's because I'm an overachiever. And so if I see a 22-year-old with an ankle sprain, like, boring, here's your ACE wrap, have a good day. If I see an older adult with an ankle sprain, there's so much to consider. Do I need to screen this patient for delirium? How am I going to adequately treat their pain without interacting with all of their other medications and causing side effects? Does this patient need help at home? Is the patient declining and deconditioning at home? Is home the safest place for them? In patients that come in with more serious illnesses, would they benefit from palliative care? Do we need to talk about advanced directives? So there's so much you can do to make the emergency department experience better for older adults. But I think the way to start is by acknowledging that older adults have more needs than younger patients. And we need to look at the older adult as a whole person, and we need to look at all the factors that led to that patient ending up in your emergency department on that visit. And that's a lot more work, but it does make the patient encounters more gratifying because you're really helping these patients beyond just their emergent problem. You're preventing additional visits and really looking at this patient as a whole person that you can impact. And that's really what I love about taking care of older adults. And I want to get other people passionate about it so that they can look at these people as whole patients, look for their functional syndromes, look for their, you know, their risk factors for falls and delirium, look at their medications and their risk for polypharmacy. If you can do any of those things, you're going to give these patients a better outcome.
Absolutely. Great, great points. Okay. So let's say your patient got their workup and it's now time for them to be discharged. What can we do to ensure a safe discharge?
As Nicole said, up to 80% of older adults discharged from the ED have at least one unrecognized geriatric problem: delirium, dementia, depression. So before you discharge an older adult, make sure to address those things. Address their mobility. Up to 20% of older adults overestimate their ability to perform simple tasks. Communicate a discharge. Communicate with their outpatient team, use large font on their discharge instructions, ask them for permission to share their discharge instructions with family members. And then finally, have some follow-up calls to try to make sure that they understand their instructions, have been able to schedule the follow-up, and they don't have any other concerns. This is a super simple way to decrease bounce backs and improve outcomes.
Another important thing to consider is that as emergency physicians, we're always thinking about the disposition. Is this patient being admitted or are they going home? But there are other options. Luckily, in my emergency department, COVID actually had one benefit, which was that it brought our nursing facilities and our assisted living facilities and all these care providers together of how can we keep these people out of the hospital? How can we keep them from getting, you know, being unsafe at home? And so we can get a case manager and a physical therapy evaluation in our emergency department during business hours, of course, but and maybe get that patient placed in assisted living. We can get home care for them. We can, you know, coordinate an outpatient assessment. And so if you can do any of those things, you may be able to prevent the risk of an admission, but also not send this patient home where they're unsafe. And so those are some options that you can explore with your case managers and social workers and see if maybe those would be available to your emergency department.
That's fantastic. Such great processes that you guys have set up. And you've inspired me to learn more about this. So where can physicians not specifically trained in geriatrics boost their knowledge?
ED guidelines are being updated as we speak. So keep an eye out for this new resource coming soon to a website near you.
This article also includes a list of additional reading at the end, which may be helpful for people who are still curious and want to learn more.
Awesome, awesome. Nicole, any final thoughts you want to leave our listeners with?
So the reason I love this article is because I think it gives some great insights to people that want to take better care of older adults but don't have the funding or the resources to build a whole new emergency department with fancy lighting and new colors and all these other fancy trinkets and things that help with older adults. This is stuff that you could incorporate in your next day of practice. You could just change the font on your discharge instructions to make it easier to read. You could commit to calling a patient's primary care doctor once a shift to set up a warm handoff. You could help your patients to have access to mobility aids in the emergency department. And so I think if you can come away from this article with one tip or trick just to make things easier for your older adults, that would be a win for us. The last thing I wanted to highlight is the cases in this article are all cases that I have seen. Sometimes when I read these articles in journals or magazines and I go, that case doesn't sound real. These were all cases that I saw in my emergency department in my practice. And so these things happen. These older adults do bounce back to the ER. They do have adverse outcomes when they're hospitalized unnecessarily. They can get disoriented in the ED. They are afraid of getting COVID in our waiting rooms and they'll delay care. So all of the things that we talk about in the article apply in real life. And so I really hope people take away that this is something they can apply at their next shift and really take a little bit better care of their older adults and really garner some good big rewards from that.
Great. Thank you so much. I'm inspired. Hopefully our listeners are too. So let's do better for our older adults.
Well, thank you, Nicole, for writing this article and joining us. And thank you, Dania, too.
So for our drug books this month, it's fidaxomicin. Tell us, Wendy.
Yeah, another antimicrobial that we have to remember how to spell. But I think quite interesting. It's a new antibiotic used to treat C. diff colitis. And actually, I guess, hot off the press, the American College of Gastroenterology, the IDSA, the Society of Healthcare Epidemiology of America have all updated their guidelines that fidaxomicin is now the first-line therapy for C. diff colitis, C. diff infections. A 10-day course is generally sufficient. Oral vancomycin is still an acceptable alternative, but data does seem to show that the fidaxomicin has a better sustained response. A longer course might be necessary if the patient seem to have a delayed treatment response. And if the patient actually has recurrent C. diff infections, these patients actually need to be treated for even up to 35 days with kind of a taper to their dosing. For those with macrolide allergies, though, there could be a hypersensitivity reaction.
Coming to a hospital near you, maybe, perhaps. I mean, it's first line. It should come to a hospital near you. Not the C. diff, the medicine, though. Well, there will be C. diff in the hospital near you, too. But I digress. So for the talks box this month, finally, our carbamazepine poisoning. Carbamazepine is an anti-epileptic, which is also used as a mood stabilizer. It's a sodium channel blocker, therefore it inhibits neuronal depolarization and glutamate release. But in massive ingestions, it also has anticholinergic effects. Altered mental status can occur with doses as little as 20 milligrams per kilo, which is like therapeutic. But cardiac toxicity occurs when we're talking about things that are more than 50 milligrams per kilo. So like a real, real overdose. Peak levels can be delayed 12 or more hours. And in extended release formulation, we're talking 96 hours or longer. So make sure to keep that in mind if your patient presents immediately after that ingestion. Patients can present with sedation, ataxia, myoclonus, seizures, nystagmus. And then the cardiac stuff would be like your cura's prolongation and with that hypotension as well, and they can present with anticholinergic symptoms. The treatment is supportive, including sodium bicarb for the QRS widening, benzos or propofol for the seizures, and in severe cases, dialysis may be helpful. So keep that in mind.
Great reminders.
Well, thank you, Wendy, for taking the time to go through this issue with me. Our dear listeners, I hope you enjoyed listening to us as much as we've enjoyed recording this.
We hope you find the Critical Decisions publication and our podcast always informative, often enlightening, and never boring.
Share your thoughts and feedback with us on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at Danya Kojo.
Mine is at EM_NCC.
And until next month,
bye-bye.